Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Joshua Rubenstein of Amnesty International USA, who summarizes his group's call for senior American officials responsible for policies condoning torture of terrorist suspects to face prosecution. U.S. Army Iraq veteran and Operation Truth activist Perry Jeffries, who takes a critical look at the conditions under which American soldiers are fighting in Iraq and his view on the real reasons President Bush took the nation to war. And Mariela Zacarias of the group Latinos Contra la Guerra, or Latinos Against War, who describes how the war in Iraq has disproportionately affected Latino youth, increasingly targeted in military recruitment drives. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A 17-day march by 12,000 landless peasants in Brazil campaigning for more aggressive land reform by President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva ended in a confrontation with police in mid-May. According to the London-based independent newspaper, more than 50 people were injured as riot police charged protesters mobilized by Brazil's powerful Landless Workers Movement, or MST. It was the worst political violence in the capital city of Brasilia in many years. MST, which has organized over 1.5 million peasants in Brazil, threatened to withhold its support for Lula in the 2006 presidential election if the government did not meet its pledge of providing 430,000 families with farm plots by next year. To pay off its foreign debt, Lula has frozen money for land resettlement. At the current pace, it will take 150 years to meet the needs of landless peasants. After the march, MST claimed it got a commitment to release $280 million for land resettlement and to hire 1,300 new land reform agents. In recent weeks, MST has threatened to increase its efforts to occupy unused farmland. Brazil has one of the world's most unequal ratios of land distribution, with 1% of farmers owning 45% of the productive farmland. In a split 5-4 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected an appeal that argued that 51 Mexicans on death row had been denied legal aid. The appeal was brought by Jose Medellin, who was sentenced to death in Texas in 1994 on murder and rape charges. Medellin requested a hearing in U.S. federal court to show that his right to a lawyer was violated. According to the Associated Press, President George Bush has ordered the case of the 51 Mexicans on death row to be reviewed by state courts. At issue is whether the conviction of foreign nationals in American courts violated the Vienna Convention, which the U.S. ratified in 1969 and allows U.S. citizens arrested abroad and foreigners arrested in the U.S. access to their consulates. Last year, the International Court of Justice in The Hague ruled that American courts had violated the Vienna Convention. The majority decision, written by Chief Justice William Rehnquist, rejected the appeal and instead relied on the state courts as the proper forum for claims made under the Vienna Convention. In the dissenting opinion, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor stated that federal courts should review the matter since it deals with the issue of international law and its precedence over national law. Overcoming a veto threat by President George Bush and opposition by Republican leaders, the House of Representatives voted to increase funding for embryonic stem cell research by a vote of 238-194. 50 Republicans voted for the bill, sponsored by Congressman Mike Castle, a Delaware Republican, and Diane DeGette, a Colorado Democrat. The bill would repeal President Bush's 2001 ban on new embryonic stem cell research and fund research on leftover embryos in fertility clinics. The vote came just days after South Korean scientists disclosed a new advancement in therapeutic cloning as a possible means of cloning nerves or heart muscle for specific patients. According to the Progressive magazine, under Dr. Leon Cass, a Bush appointee heading the administration's Council on Bioethics, the board has moved sharply in a conservative direction. It has endorsed a long-term ban on human cloning, a moratorium on therapeutic cloning, and stiff restrictions on embryonic stem cell research, running counter to mainstream scientific opinion. Recent appointees to the Bioethics Council have set off alarm bells among scientific researchers. Among them is Peter Augustine Lawler, a professor at Berry College in Georgia, who is the author of the book Aliens in America: The Strange Truth About Our Souls. As Arthur Kaplan, head of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, observed, the credentials of these appointees are sparse and dubious. They are lightweights when it comes to bioethics. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In a severe condemnation of U.S. conduct in its war against terrorism, Amnesty International Secretary General Irene Khan charged that the Bush administration had abdicated its responsibility to set a global example in upholding human rights. Speaking at a May 25th news conference in London, unveiling the group's annual human rights report, Khan said, "The American-run prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, has become the gulag of our time." Amnesty International is calling for the closing of the Guantanamo detention facility, which currently holds some 540 prisoners from 40 nations, many detained without charge and some held more than 3 years. Over the past year, investigations by the International Committee of the Red Cross and the FBI have revealed documented cases of abuse and torture at the hands of U.S. personnel at Guantanamo and prisons in Iraq and Afghanistan. William Schultz, executive director of Amnesty International USA, called on foreign governments to investigate and prosecute all senior U.S. officials who have violated the Geneva Conventions and the UN Convention Against Torture. Among those he named were President Bush, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, and Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Joshua Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International USA, who summarizes his group's condemnation of Bush administration policies that have condoned torture.
Amnesty issues what we call our annual report every spring. As in all these years, there are reports on over 140 countries. And so we highlight the ongoing crisis in Darfur, where nearly 2 million refugees have been created. Many of them are staying in camps on both sides of the border with Chad. We talk about the ongoing crisis in Congo, where more than 3 million casualties have taken place. We talk about Chechnya and Russia. So this is a report that covers the whole globe. But, of course, we have focused on the United States this year because of this scandal regarding torture. It was just a year ago that the world was alerted to the mistreatment and torture of prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad, Iraq. And what we've learned since then has really reinforced our concerns. It turns out that leading officials in the government, in the Pentagon, in the White House, in the Department of Justice, were drafting memorandums not only justifying the use of torture, but coming up with contrived arguments in order to protect American personnel from being accused of using torture. So these are very contrived legal arguments, and they, genuinely reinforced the mistreatment and the torture that we are now finding out about in Afghanistan, in Guantanamo, and in Iraq. Plus, we're now focusing on this policy of extraordinary rendition, that the United States takes prisoners either from the United States or from a different country, say in Europe, and sends them to Syria or Egypt or Jordan for interrogation. Now, why would they do that? We believe it's because they rely on those countries to interrogate these prisoners using torture, and the U.S. wants to keep somewhat of a distance, to keep its hands clean while it has surrogates carry out this kind of interrogation. In a sense, we call it outsourcing torture. So this is what is focused on in the report.
Could you be specific about the kinds of torture that you believe is linked directly to official U.S. policy rather than the actions of rogue or sadistic guards or interrogators? Because the idea that lower-level soldiers are responsible for this is really the essence of how the White House has responded to this scandal.
Well, we feel there has been a real whitewash by blaming all of these lower-down personnel and try to keep the investigations away from people in the command structure. Approximately 125 members of the U.S. Armed Forces have either been court-martialed or received non-judicial punishment or other administrative action. But to date, no one in the extended chain of command, including those who formulated policies on the treatment and interrogation of prisoners, has been held accountable. So, for example, we now know that CIA operatives were abusing prisoners with waterboarding. That's where you put a person's head or you strap them to a board and they go below water. You immerse them in water and they fear they may be drowned because their head is below water for a certain amount of time, and you threaten them with drowning. And this is a common form of torture in Latin America, for example. And here we believe U.S. CIA agents have been using this form of torture. There's a certain term called stress position. Now, on the surface of things, this may seem like a superficial or not so intrusive kind of torture where you tie someone to a chair where they're not seated properly, it's awkward for them. But when you keep someone there indefinitely for many, many hours or days at a time, this becomes extremely painful. Or sleep deprivation. That may not leave physical scars. But when you do not permit someone to sleep for several days at a time, this becomes very disorienting and painful. It can have a severe impact on one's health. This is simply a form of torture. We knew about it during Stalin's time. Why should it be okay for representatives of the United States to use these techniques? Mr. Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, suggested threatening people with dogs. And we have photographs from Abu Ghraib where officers are seen holding these large, menacing German shepherds in front of prisoners. So we believe there's a direct connection between the techniques that American officials in Washington were proposing and the treatment that we know occurred in Bagram, Afghanistan, in Abu Ghraib, and at Guantanamo.
Tell us about Amnesty's call for other governments to investigate and possibly prosecute high-level officials in the Bush administration, such as Attorney General Gonzalez, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, and others in the Pentagon.
The call for international response to this torture scandal is based on the fact that there has not been an adequate investigation here in the United States. If there were an adequate investigation, there would be no need for European governments to have investigations of their own. Torture can be prosecuted around the world. There's universal jurisdiction. That's why General Pinochet was indicted by a Spanish judge. That's why courts in Belgium considered indicting other government leaders from other parts of the world. And the fact is that there's no statute of limitations on torture, that the U.S. is party to a convention that grants over 120 countries the power to investigate torture by government leaders in any country of the world. And so right now it may obviously seem unlikely that, say, a European government would indict President Bush or Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld or someone else. But when this group leaves office, when they are private citizens, when they travel, it's quite possible that a prosecutor in Germany or Spain or another country would seek an indictment. And that would be perfectly legitimate as long as it was based on serious and genuine investigation and hard evidence.
That was Joshua Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director with Amnesty International USA. Contact Amnesty by calling area code 212-807-8400 or visit their website at www.amnestyusa.org. In recent weeks, insurgents fighting U.S. troops and their Iraqi allies have sharply escalated their attacks. Hundreds of soldiers and civilians have died as a result of suicide bombings, ambushes, and roadside bombs targeting military and police vehicles. The plan by Iraq's interim government to deploy some 40,000 U.S.-trained troops to crack down on rebels was met by fierce resistance and coordinated counterattacks by insurgents. With the escalating violence comes new signs of inter-ethnic conflict between Shia and Sunnis. Sunnis, who largely boycotted Iraq's national election in January, are reported to be growing fearful of the Shiite-majority government's counterinsurgency campaign. Fueling concern was a May 30th incident in which American troops briefly arrested a powerful Sunni political leader, Mohsen Abdul Hamid. Mr. Hamid, the leader of the Iraqi Islamic Party, was later released after the U.S. command claimed it had detained him by mistake. Perry Jeffries served as a first sergeant with the U.S. Army's 4th Infantry Division in occupied Iraq and was among the soldiers in the first wave of invasion forces in March 2003. Jeffries left the Army in October 2003 and became active with the veterans advocacy group Operation Truth, where he now serves as veterans coordinator. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jeffries, who takes a critical look at the conditions under which American soldiers are fighting in Iraq, and his view on the real reasons President Bush took the U.S. to war.
What's really disappointing is we put over $14 million into State Department computer models that pretty much nailed exactly what's happening then and now. And our Department of Defense ignored those in favor of, you know, Wolfowitz and Pearl's predictions about flowers being stuck in the end of our rifle barrels and stuff like that. And then they went and they dropped all these leaflets, 22 million leaflets they dropped in Iraq that said, you know, don't fight, we're coming with food, water, medicine. And as soon as we crossed into Iraq, first thing we saw was children standing on the side of the road holding these leaflets. You know, and my soldiers were very distressed. They said, well, Top, we don't have any humanitarian rations. We barely have enough water for ourselves. How do we honor this promise? And if there was anybody that had any doubt, you know, that we'd been sold a hog, they knew at that point. So it was pretty tough. And then it meant my truck drivers had to do a lot of extra driving. We had to do our own searching for supplies, things like that, because these chains hadn't been established. We had gone in without the proper diplomatic coordination. So a lot of the supplies that were designated for us had begun moving into Europe, thinking we were coming from Turkey. And then, of course, we didn't come from Turkey. We waited to the last second, and we came from the south. And that really threw a wrench in the plans. But, one, it was an option to go when we went. So they could have waited until we were more ready or just not have gone at all. And then, two, there are means available to do that. But the soldier on the ground is just still not considered the top priority for a lot of our, you know, senior planners.
But you're saying that it seems in your mind that the actual soldiers on the ground were not a top priority. If the soldiers on the ground weren't the top priority, what was the top priority, do you think?
Well, I mean, we know from our orders that securing the oil fields, which to some degree makes some sense, but not as your primary and only mission, that was the number one priority. And the fact is that in all these conflicts, you end up using soldiers on the ground. So all these weapons they buy, all these multi-billion-dollar projects like these ridiculous missile defense program or the C-130J or whatever it happens to be that put lines in the pockets of these contractors, those things don't accomplish the mission. What accomplishes the mission is Joe, G.I. Joe, soldier and soldiers on the ground doing their job. And if we were to build a robot to do the same thing, we'd spend $1 billion on it. We'd line it with Kevlar and titanium. And yet we only spend about $2,600 to protect a soldier. And yet that's the best weapon we got. And to me, it's one of our best national resources.
There's a wave of violence right now that Iraq is experiencing at the same time as U.S.-trained Iraqi forces are out in force. What do you think is going to happen? A lot of people are talking about a civil war, or barring that, just the nation of Iran may very well be the most influential power on that nation's government in the near to not too distant future.
I personally, and this is not a op-proof statement or anything like that, but I personally think that if we get out at any time in the foreseeable future, whatever the stability of the country is, I think as soon as we leave, it's going to balkanize, that it will separate or go to full-on civil war. We haven't allowed them to pick strong leaders yet. There's a lot of sectarian violence there. It's easy for the news here to say it's all foreign fighters, but there's probably only a few hundred to up to maybe 1,000 foreign fighters there. This is Iraqis wanting to get us out of their country. And once we're out, then they're going to take each other on and settle their old scores, and I don't think it's going to be a pretty sight. So if it was just me, if I was king for a day, I would probably start to move out and see if I could get Arab nations or somebody to come in behind me or with me to help me. Obviously, you cannot get out. There's too large an element, too much stuff to take out of there safely or just to get out of there, period, in a very short period of time. It's going to take months, not weeks. But I would begin to move back south and let the Iraqis fill it in if they could. And if they couldn't, then that's probably the situation it's going to live with until it, you know, finds its natural settling point.
Perry Jeffries, why do you think this war was fought? What were the real motivations of the Bush administration in taking on Saddam Hussein and saying what they did about weapons of mass destruction and the like?
Well, I think we have that out in the Downing Street memo now, but I think the war is fought over oil and corporate profits. As long as we have these big contractors allowed to help write their own contracts, these cost-plus contracts, and get involved in the theater of war, they're going to continue to push things like this. And it's just a system that feeds upon itself so that outside voices are excluded. You know, and I think that each part of the administration had their own motivation, but you can look to PNAC, the Project for the New American Century. They planned this war out back in the 90s, and as soon as George Bush came to power, all those same group of people were put into place in our government, and sure enough, off we went. So I think that if any one of those people had ever been to war, had ever served honorably in the armed forces, and seen their friends, you know, get injured or killed, that they might have had a very different thought. But they've been allowed to avoid that, and now there's other soldiers on the ground, you know, fighting their fantasy for them.
That was former U.S. Army First Sergeant Perry Jeffries, who was now active with the veterans advocacy group Operation Truth. Call Operation Truth at area code 212-982-8645 or visit their website at www.optruth.org. The Pentagon invoked a mid-May stand-down of military recruiters in order to reorient them in the legal requirements of their job, since many were carrying out illegal activities in their ever more desperate efforts to meet recruitment quotas. As U.S. casualties have continued to mount in Iraq, with no end to the conflict in sight, both the Army and the Marines have failed to meet their quotas over the past several months. According to Army officials, as of April 30, 2005, the Army had achieved only 85% of its target for the first 5 months of the fiscal year, which began October 1, 2004. This recruitment shortfall has come despite offering the largest enlistment bonuses in Army history. Recruiters have stepped up their contacts with high school students to a degree that in many cases can only be described as harassment. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mariela Zacarias, who works with the Connecticut-based group Latinos Contra la Guerra, or Latinos Against War. She describes how the war in Iraq has disproportionately affected Latinos, in part because low-income Latino youth are more vulnerable to military recruitment as they have fewer employment or educational opportunities.
The war has a lot of effects on the Latino community, and even though lots of things are happening that relate to the war, the Latino community wasn't too involved in the anti-war movement. And we felt that it was needed to have, you know, we needed to have an organization that was catered specifically to Latinos where we could create a safe and positive environment for people to express their views, where we could speak Spanish at the meetings, and we could really address how the war affects our community. And so that's why we started it, reaching out to youth, to older people, to people from all parts of Latin America and the Caribbean. And it grew very rapidly.
What are some of the ways that the war has affected the Latino community in particular?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of money. A lot of money is being spent on the war. Just from Hartford, $80 million have been spent in the war in Iraq. So there's always money that is being spent on a war in Iraq, when the money for programs for education, for healthcare, for housing are being cut. This obviously affects the poor the most. Another thing that is happening is that the military needs a lot of young people to, you know, to be soldiers for the war, and they're coming to our schools, to our high schools and colleges to recruit. And again, in the same way that people who, you know, are wealthy and have, you know, enough money to send their kids to college, they don't have to go to the military for these things. But so the military really tries to go to schools where there's a lot of kids who might not have enough money to go to college, who might not have as many opportunities to get jobs.
Have you seen over the past year any change in the community in terms of the numbers of young people who are joining the military? Has it dropped at all?
It has. It has dropped dramatically in all the different branches of the military. Actually, it started with the National Guard, and it's, you know, it's sort of an obvious thing to happen just because the National Guard usually is people who have other jobs and who just join with the promise of just going once a month and training once a month. And because of all these people having sent to war and they were not, you know, expecting to be at war, then less and less people are joining the National Guard. But then we find people from places like the Marines. The Marines had a history of actually sending people away because they didn't have enough spaces for people, because everybody wanted to be a Marine. And for the first time in January, they couldn't make their goals. And the same thing is happening in all the branches of the military. They're using their reserves, meaning people who signed up and deferred their entrance for a year or two. And these people are being used right now because they don't have enough. I know that African-American recruitment has gone down a lot. You know, people in the African-American community don't believe in the war for the most part and are not willing to send their children to it. However, the recruiters are really targeting the Latino community, and they've said so in the paper, because, you know, the Latino community is growing and because it's a very working class and poor community. But it has dramatically gone down, and because of this, the military has doubled the amount of money that they're spending on recruitment. They doubled the amount of recruiters they're sending to the schools. You know, they're using a lot more money for advertisements, for magazines.
Opponents of the war are starting to organize around the fact that the No Child Left Behind law allows military recruiters access to students' personal information, like home phone numbers. Do you talk to Latino students and their parents about that?
We do. That's one of the first things we tell the students when we go into the schools. We explain to them that because of the No Child Left Behind, their information is being shared with to the military recruiters. And we have a form that they can fill out and give to their principal to remove their names from the list of the recruiters. If you talk to some of the principals, they say that at the beginning of the year, they send a letter to the parents, you know, and explains that they can remove their names from the recruiters list. But I have talked to hundreds of students and parents, and no one has ever seen this, probably buried in, you know, a lot of letters. So the students don't know about it. The kids just grab them from us and give them to their friends, you know, because a lot of these kids are really sick of being called constantly or having people come to their houses or just being harassed by their recruiters.
That was Mariela Zacarias of Latinos Contra la Guerra, or Latinos Against War, part of the Alternatives to Military Recruitment Coalition. Contact the coalition at area code 413-210-7374 or visit their website at www.afsc.org/youthmill. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.